Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 12 of What's Wrong with the Podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to Nick Tidball. Nick is the co-founder of Volibec. Founded together with his twin brother, Steve, Volibec is a three-year-old startup taking on the fashion industry by using science and technology to make the future of clothing happen faster. They have created the world's first graphene jacket using the only material in the world with a Nobel Prize, released 100-year clothing designed to outlive you, a plant algae t-shirt grown in forests that biodegrades into worm food in 12 weeks, and a black squid jacket which mimics the adaptive camouflage of the squid by reflecting every color in the visible spectrum. Quantum leaps in technology are required for the creation of their gear, from new production methods to entirely new materials which have never been seen before. Volibec does research into people's attitudes in risk, adventure, mortality, and space, and the frontiers humanity needs to explore over the next century and beyond. Nick, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So you have an amazing story. Can you please tell us a bit about yourself and how you got to what you're doing today?
Yes. Of course. So what I'm doing today, or what I'm trying to do with my brother, twin brother actually, is make the future of clothing. But it didn't start like that, obviously. I went to school like everyone else. I think in my early, when I was a kid, I basically played the piano and did sport and art. And that was about it. And then you have that weird moment at school where you're not very old, but someone says, what are you going to do? And I randomly said, architecture. And I kind of actually really like buildings. But I think at the time I liked M.C. Escher and Gaudi and people like that. But it was enough to find architecture interesting where you realize you can put something into the world that's physical and huge and interesting and can help shape the world. So I did that for 3 years at Newcastle University, which I didn't enjoy at all, actually. And then I did my whatever the end bit is, your diploma. I did that at UCL, the Bartlett, under Peter Cook. And that was amazing. I loved it. You got to work with people from all around the world, and your tutors were super smart and they were very nice people. And they got you to intellectually look at briefs and what your solutions to those briefs might be in a way that I'd never been exposed to before, probably because someone like Peter Cook ran the department, right? And he'd done Archigram, and so when you've got someone like that advising you when most of his buildings were fictitious, it kind of allowed you to do really quite creative, interesting things, which you were then encouraged to do. And I think that was the first time I'd ever worked in a truly creative environment. And then randomly my brother and I We went into advertising, actually, and I became an art director and he became a copywriter, and his degree was in art history. I always did drawings and he always wrote lots of essays, because I think art history was essentially about, you know, writing essays. Yeah. And we didn't really speak to each other at university very much. But then I think we'd seen a television program where we'd seen that these creative people would go and create whole worlds for brands. And I think we were both just quite attracted to it, really. A lot of your early life isn't the most thought through. And after 6 years of architecture, it probably wasn't the most thought through decision. But we did it.
But very interesting you gravitated towards that, like both of you too. That's very interesting.
I know, honestly, I think it was because of this TV program we'd just seen, where you got to see that you had this job called creatives, and they worked in pairs always. They weren't, obviously most creatives aren't twin brothers. They're normally just people you meet. And you got to do ideas for companies, and your ideas could be radio or designed or built or television or, and obviously in the start of your careers, you don't actually have the ability to do ideas across multimedia. You're more just given the work that no one else wants to do. Yeah. But by the end of our careers, we were, to be honest, we just built physical manifestations of the brands for brands, and I went back to architecture. So Airbnb, near the end of our advertising careers, came to us and said they wanted to basically, no one knew them in the UK. So I designed them a floating house, which I floated down the Thames, and it was art directed like a Pixar house, and you could stay in it. But it was a complete architectural answer.
Yeah.
But for me, it made so much sense, because, you know, you could do a television advert for them, but it's never really going to embody what they actually represent. What they actually represented was something really quite interesting, where you could stay in places that traditionally you'd never ever get to stay, because that used to be the hotel industry. Well, bread and breakfast, then Airbnb come along.
Yeah.
And then you can stay in all these places. So for me, a floating house down the Thames was a perfectly logical answer. And then obviously architecture plays a huge part in that, because, you know, you've studied for 6 years and you've done a lot of art direction and advertising. And then so very quickly you pick an aesthetic, don't you? And because I wasn't an architect at that point, mm-hmm. but I'd studied it, you then have to go, well, how do I want it to look? And I obviously gravitated towards Up and Pixar and playfulness and Disney, mm-hmm. Because I think that was just the kind of thing that made for a really beautiful idea. And obviously Pixar you could build that for real. You can do it as a kid's film. You could art direct it as an adult film. And I think all the bits of design I've worked across, I think that's it's probably what all designers and creatives are looking for, isn't it? It's just great ideas
right. That
are very understandable and gettable by people. But then there was a transition 4 years ago where my brother and I, we didn't want to work for those companies anymore, because, well, quite honestly, I'd read a few books. So Steve Jobs' autobiography, mm-hmm. Phil Knight of Nike, Yvon Chouinard of Patagonia. And we both thought, do you know what? I think we should run our own brand. And, you know, we had wives and mortgages and children. So it was an entirely logical and risky move. It made so much sense. Yeah. And amazingly, they said, yeah, we think you should go for it. And then I was supposed when we started the company, I think like when you start everything, it's a bit of a small, it's like a diamond in the rough, right? You have this idea for whether it's an idea for a building or a piece of design or a company. I think it obviously starts in your head.
Right.
And then it works its way into you, and until you go, oh, this, it could be that. I don't think there was any moment of, God, he must definitely do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more stumbling across it. And then you realize, yes, if you did create your own company, and where we tried to create the future of clothes, we could do X, Y, and Z. And then you just take your first steps into it. You know, I'd never gone to business school, nor my brother, who'd done, you know, architecture and art history. I think advertising teaches you a certain amount, mm-hmm. in terms of business, but I think nothing teaches you it like doing it for yourself.
Of course.
In the open marketplace where, you know, you make stuff and will people buy it?
Yeah, I actually, and since we talked about Pixar, my favorite business book, which is such a non-business book, is Creativity Inc. by Ed Catmull. You know, like,
yes,
because he talks about like challenges of business, and then like at the same time, there, you know, all these like books that are more like recipes for like 10 ways you can like start your business like this, like those never work. And no. So but the mindset that he's putting forward is really what you like need to have on an ongoing basis, which is why it became my favorite book.
Yeah, I agree, because I think all those guys, they combine a desire for what they want to do with their lives, and they want to do something beyond that goes beyond their lifetime, and then they mix it with a mission, and it's so powerful. I think, I don't know, maybe his business always been like that. I don't know. I think you probably always had great things happen in business. Like, so Ford, for example, I think famously once said, if you ask people what they want, they'd have said a faster horse, and he built a car.
Right.
And I think in the same way, Disney, no one asked him to build Disneyland.
Right.
He was making Disney films. He was a millionaire off it. And then he started getting obsessed with trains. For me and my brother, and I think for probably all the people who'd admire, they've absolutely followed their vision and what they want to do and their passion. And then if money is a byproduct of that, then it is. But the first port of call is, what do I want to do with my time on earth? And I think my brother and I had both got to the stage where we were 36 at the time, we're 40 now. And at 36, I think we were just keen to do something for ourselves.
Why clothing?
Well, at the same time as doing advertising, mm-hmm. we had been running ultramarathons around the world. And I guess we were both pretty obsessed by design. I think we were pretty obsessed by clothing and certainly its place in adventure. And I think we roughly felt there was not a gap in the market. I don't actually think there was a gap, but I think what we saw was the potential was to create a new space. And I think actually the lot of advice we got off people is the market is full. You know, there's all these sports brands out there doing all these things. And I think we saw it a little differently. You know, my brother and I were both quite obsessed with chefs. And in our original idea for this, we'd sort of loved the idea of doing something a bit like El Bulli, which was at one point the world's best restaurant.
That's very interesting, because I feel like there's a lot of similarities between architects and chefs. Like I always find that like comparison very interesting, whereas like maybe architects build things that are permanent, but chefs, it's more like ephemeral. Like it's just like, it's gone in 5 minutes, right? Especially if it's good food, maybe.
That's right.
But at the same time, the creativity, the construction, even like the structural components to it, like there's just, I feel like there's so many similarities. That's so interesting that you say that.
I agree. It's utterly identical. The best chefs in the world, it's identical to design and architecture. And what we love particularly about it was the absolute attention to detail. And so I think when we first started the business, we were like, if you could do something along the lines of El Bulli, but for clothing, certainly with the same amount of integrity, the same amount of drive, and the same amount of research, and going, we believe, after all of our work and our research and our testing mixed with our ideas, that this is a particularly good thing. And then if people want to come and buy your clothing or helicopter you to a restaurant, they can. But I think what they get is someone has absolutely gone for it, whether it's us or El Bulli or an architect, and said, this is what we believe is one of the best things in the world.
Yeah, and which is so rare, especially in the fashion industry. And I guess like we can move on to sort of like what we see that are challenges in the industry. But before that, like I think fashion is so interesting in the sense that, well, first of all, it made sense to you just because of your like personal experience. It really is a common thread through all of our lives. Like whether or not you care about fashion, everyone still has a style of their own. And we still like, unless we don't decide not to dress up anymore, like everybody's sort of like tied into the industry. Yeah. So it's such a common thread and like relatable, much more relatable and accessible design element. I think like it's just so interesting to me that it's such a common language in anywhere in the world. Like you can talk to people about fashion right away.
Yes, I'd agree with that. Yes.
At the same time, I guess mentioning sort of some of the problems we see in the industry, it's like one of the industries that has the least amount of technological advancements. And I don't want to like, and maybe this is like wrong.
No, you're totally correct. I think this is what my brother and I thought when we started Followback. It's there's no one going for it. Or in our opinion, there wasn't anyway. In the way that there is in architecture or in design that has to interact with the human body, or even in food. I think food's progressed more.
Yeah.
I think clothing, obviously you have a lot of clothing brands and you have people with huge, natural affiliations with one thing because they've grown up with it. But essentially, I think we felt it was quite generic. There's a lot of brands where you could take a logo off a piece of clothing and the brands are entirely interchangeable.
Right.
And that's one thing we definitely felt. And but I suppose the same happens with a lot of architecture, right? A lot of bad architecture, you look at it, certainly whether in the UK where I am or in America, there's a lot of generic stuff built and you just go, wow, is that really what you wanted to do?
Yeah, and today, like, I think the field of architecture is just driven so much by the economy. It's like they're very commercially friendly, right? So whereas we saw these like crazy artworks being built in the past, and you know, our partners both worked with Zaha Hadid, so she was, I think, one of the few last ones who were sort of trying to like realize a vision, right? And now we're seeing like much more pixelated versions of all these like designs in the past being built just because it's just more efficient. So I mean,
when her drawings came on, I think I remember seeing the original, was she at the AA? I think I remember seeing her drawings, or maybe her drawings from her first practice, and you're like, wow, this is very different. This is wild.
Yeah. And I'm very curious to see, like, because we know her story so well because our team knew her personally. And I think Like, what she pushed for, obviously, it wasn't easy, right? Like, the first project, I think, Zahedi's office got was, like, in 10 years. And she had to, like, sustain that office through her artwork and other things in the meantime. How did you get the first product out? Which was it, by the way, for people who haven't, like, looked into Balabag products?
Well, we made a fairly great... Well, what you're probably meant to do if you start an outdoors or adventure brand is probably make a red waterproof jacket. Mm-hmm. And we did the opposite to that. We made a pink hoodie that zipped up over your head that was designed to relax you, based on the theory of Drunk Tank Pink, where they used to paint inmates' cells in maybe 1970s, 1980s America. They used to paint the prison cells pink to tranquilize them and calm them down. And we decided to make a hoodie to do with this. So in terms of... I don't think we necessarily did it for the PR. I think we just did it because we believed it was quite an insane and fun project to work on. My brother and I, we also work off the principle of when we're 80 or 90, will we look back and think that was fun or brilliant, or should we have done that? And it's a real interesting way to make decisions. And it's harder, obviously, when you're in advertising, because you can say, yes, I want to make that. But then, like in architecture, you're subject to a huge number of people mm-hmm. saying yes or no. And typically no, because it's incredibly easy to say no to stuff. And it's much harder to say yes to stuff, or yes, and here's how you can make it, or yes, here's how it can be better. But naturally, I gravitate towards those people because they're the exciting people. So that was our first product. And fairly funnily, within a month or two, it somehow ended up on the Jimmy Fallon show, where Jimmy was wearing it for like 10 minutes with a comedian. And I think at that point you go, oh, maybe we might be onto something here. This is quite fun. But I think even when you start the company at first, it's so fledgling. I think it's Johnny Ive who talks about the preciousness of an early idea. And it's so true. You have to be so careful. And we're not saying it wasn't that the hoodie wasn't the idea. The idea was this clothing brand that could behave completely differently. The hoodie was simply a first expression of that, of now we have lots of clothes. So it's now we have lots of expressions of what we believe to be a future facing clothing brand. And then it was simply, oh gosh, things like, how do you sell stuff? How do you send stuff around the world? How do you, and there was a lot of, to be honest, there was a lot of business stuff, which my brother and I were completely new to, but it probably helped in a way. Cause if you know what's coming up, you might not ever start it. Cause you certainly, once you start, now I have children, it is so similar to having a child. Everything you put into it, then you see in the child or the business. And it's as brilliant or as loving or as fun or as hard as you want it to be. And it's this entity that exists, right? Because then it's in the public forum and people use it. They use a building, they use clothing. But I guess that's interesting. I think all the people I've been most fascinated with, from Disney to Steve Jobs to Elon Musk, They build stuff. They build stuff that then interacts with people. And the chefs as well. That interaction.
And they all really went for it, right? Like you did.
They all go for it. Yeah. It's unapologetically going for it with a very clear mission of electric cars weren't cool, quite frankly. And then Elon came along. It was funny though, you know, electric cars, I think my brother was telling me, they were really popular in like 1910 New York. Like popular.
I think I read about this. Yeah,
and they died out. I think something to do with the petrol. But I love what Elon's done. I think the first Teslas were obviously great. But I think whether you love it or hate it, I think what's cool about what they're doing now, certainly with stuff like the Cybertruck, is there is a design where nobody has asked for it to look like that. No one on earth. But it doesn't mean people don't want it, because it looks wild. And it's fantastic, and it's different, and it's raw. I guess, funnily, I think one of the things that I suppose fascinates me about, that brings all those things together, and that rawness, is Corbusier first going, I'm going to use concrete. and everyone going, oh, no, we normally don't show the concrete. Him going, no, I'd quite like to show the concrete. And in the same way, I think it's like this crazy panel of stainless steel on the Cybertruck. And they've just gone for it with the rawness of the material. And I think in some of our clothing, and quite a lot of our clothing, actually, we get excited when the clothing or the piece of material is at its most raw.
Right.
And people are so, suppliers and material people are so expected of, oh, and what color do you want it? And so at the start, you're like, I don't want it a color. I would like to make it the color it naturally is.
Yeah.
No dye, nothing. What happens if nothing is done to it? And you often find no one has ever asked them these questions.
So
I think your architecture background, definitely in terms of, you know, in architecture, it's truth to materiality, isn't it? And all this kind of stuff. I personally feel, while truth to materiality has been experimented a bit with in clothing, I don't believe it's got anywhere compared to where it could go. And that's probably one of our largest experiments is to do with that and a perpetual fascination with materials.
Yeah.
And rather luckily for us, materials are constantly something which are developing, right? They're
right.
Never in a stasis. That materiality is never going to stay still.
Right.
But, you know, nylon back in the day was New York and London, wasn't it? So people created nylon.
Mm.
And you're always going to have stuff like that going on.
Right.
But so, yeah, that's just one of the angles we look at. Yeah.
I think what you are also embodying is the perfect example of this like multidisciplinary approach to like a real example of collaboration to come up with solutions or innovations within an industry, right? And we always talk about like it is so hard to come up with any progress-making idea or any innovation without having that multidisciplinary approach to it. So can you walk us a little bit through that? Like you obviously, you and your brother have already diverse backgrounds, but what type of collaboration does, for example, creating the graphene jacket entails, or like black squid jacket entails? Like what is the design process and the, I guess the making process of it?
God, it's quite hard to explain. Someone asked me the R&D process the other day for what we did. And I sort of apologetically had to say, well, it's most of it is my brain. And I naturally gravitate towards things that other people don't gravitate towards. I'm not quite sure why. I think maybe architecture teaches you that, or advertising. And it teaches you to just go and look around the world. And whether it's a documentary on garbage or I just watched a documentary on The Biggest Little Farm, where two LA farmers try to make it from scratch. I will watch and I will consume anything because you never know where it's going to lead. And I think we saw an exhibition the other day, and it was Oliver Eliasson, who I think is one of the best artists in the world, who, interestingly, I think he collaborates incredibly well with other people to make world-class art. And his exhibition, at the end of it, the most fascinating room was where he put all of his workings on the final wall. And it was maybe a 50-meter wall of everything he thinks, every working out, the idea from start to finish. And while he is a world-famous artist, and we're just getting going, I thought the similarities were interesting. So first off, we just built a indestructible puffer jacket, and I'll start with that as an example. And it always amused me that these things that took you to crazy places and were designed to keep you warm had a very, very simple fail point, which is they could tear incredibly easily.
True.
And they weren't going to last forever. And they were filled with duck feathers. And you start analyzing it. And I understand how these things happen. People have a budget and they say, this top is going to cost me X to make. Therefore, I'm going to fill it with this. The zips are going to be this. The material is going to be this. The market dictates you want a blue one, you want a red one. And that's a price point from $200 to $2,000. They all go through the same thing. And that's fine because they can, because I'm talking about companies do $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion in revenue. And they have an existing audience. And they have people who are going to buy their stuff. So, but for our indestructible puffer, I'm a massive fan in what I'd call, I don't know how you call it, square one thinking, where you look at what is happening in a product normally, and you go, is that right? I don't know why they do that. And for us, the puffer jacket was a perfect example where you look at how they create the down, and you go, I never want to be part of this. And I understand that there's reasons why people do it and all that. But when you say that 80% of the industry, or 80% of the down, is from the animal industry, but then you look into what the animal industry is, and it's the birds kept for foie gras. Right. And then, so that is how they get the feathers. At which point you go, if I'm making the future of clothing, I don't think that represents
already
the future of clothing.
Yeah, wow.
I think that is basically medieval, and I wouldn't want anything to do with it. And the other, one of the guiding principles we have is I should be able to take my wife and my children or my parents through every step of what I do and be proud
and
of
no
it.
Shame.
As opposed to no shame, because my God, if you took people who wear all these jackets, and I myself used to, because you didn't know, you go and show them, and you go and show them, and you have full traceability and full transparency. People aren't going to wear those jackets as much, but some people still will. But it will radically change. But because a lot of these things are invisible, no one changes them, because no one has to, because no one asks them to. And I think transparency and visibility is going to be a thing that shifts hugely in the industry. And so we looked at the insides and said, well, our insides should be from, basically they're from plastic bottles. So it's this stuff existing, which we're looking for a solution for. I think eventually plastic will become like Bakelite.
Yeah.
And I think in 50 years, people will honestly say, in the same way I say Bakelite to some people, and people have never heard of it, yet it made the interiors of every car ever made 50 years ago. And I think plastic will become like that. So, but while we're looking for a plastic solution, it made perfect sense to us to find a supplier who had been able to make the plastic into a type of down. Yeah. And in performance wise and everything else, it's pretty much the same. And in cost, I can't actually remember. I'm never that bothered about costs, because I'm always bothered about making the best product available.
Right. Like,
and then seeing what it costs to make, and then making a sustainable business.
Because
off
that. If your jacket lasts you your entire lifetime, why should you be bothered by it? Whereas like we have to replace our coats like every 2 years. In the end, we pay so much more money to it.
It's crazy. Longevity has to be a thing that is looked at going forward. So we go two ways. Some of our clothes, like a 100-year hoodie and indestructible puffer, are designed to outlast you. And then also last year, we made a plant and algae t-shirt, which was made to last quite a long time, maybe 10 years, like a cotton t-shirt. But it's made of plants and algae, so when you bury it in the ground, it disappears. And then so on the rest of the puffer, we then had to look for an outside material that was so tough but wearable. And I came across basically Dyneema, which was a material, I feel, invented in the 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. And it's used on Arctic rope. And it's used on boat sails. So this material is super tough, and it's super amazing. And it's got some properties to it where you go, wow, this is just madness. Interestingly, a tiny piece of it frayed on my jacket the other day, and I went to cut it with scissors and I couldn't cut the fray off. And you're like, okay, this really is good. And then you have to find, and then we worked with so obviously I go through hundreds of materials to find that one, and I go through hundreds of things to find the fill, and those are the basic things for a puffer, and then you've got zips and stuff and all that kind of stuff, and then you have to design it in a way that people want to wear. And we have a particular design process in Volleback where it's a very close-knit thing with just me and someone else. Mm-hmm. And we come up with designs which most of the time it's like, well, how will it function really well? And then most of the time the form will follow that.
Right.
And occasionally it'll be a bit backwards forwards, but it'll normally be a function, because I think designing for function is brilliant. I love utilitarianism basically. And then we had to find a factory who would make it. And at which point factories get very scared,
right,
because it's very, very hard to work with this material. But as soon as the factory gets scared, I get excited. Not by the price they then quote to charge it, but I get excited because it means it's not been done before. And, you know, when you're working with the best factories and even they haven't done it before, you're like, okay, we're into an interesting territory now. I think we want to have Daniel Liebeskind talk to us a long time ago at the Bartlett. And I think back in the day, he really scared structural engineers because he really tried to pull off some mad stuff.
Yeah.
And I think his is maybe looks over function, but nonetheless I think in scaring the people and doing new things, you know, you're into an interesting territory. And I think it's that territory that my brother and I want to live in, where then you can hold up a jacket and you go, this survives, this will happily go down to minus 50 in the Arctic. But similarly, I can wear it on a New York day, just like in the autumn or the spring or the winter. And I also love it because you can't cut it with a knife. And it's so tough. So if you fall over, if you scrape a wall, if you fall down skiing, if you scratch it with rocks, nothing happens.
You really, really nailed it on like this, like the how fashion industry is functioning today is not sustainable at all, especially with the current like just data gathering and transparency in data is just pushing the brands to sort of, you know, be honest about what they're utilizing, right? And I think, you know, they have the big monies to sort of like drive PR as they should, which the fashion industry has been doing for many, many years. They're sort of like guiding the customer on what they should be doing for many years now. Whereas I think we're going to be at a time as even like there are conversations about incorporating blockchain into fashion so that people have to like declare where they're sourcing what and how is everything being done. Like that transparency is going to push the industry so much more to basically be just responsible of how they're doing business in general. And I think like being a parent really gives you the realization, okay, I want my children to be proud of me. And 10 years from now, they actually see what I'm doing. They're not like, well, like dad, mom, why are you doing this? Like, this is so not cool. You know, just like,
which would definitely happen.
Like you have to remain the cool parent in their eyes, but like you really want, you feel more of a responsibility to the next generation. And so you actually, I think then you go for it even further, but I think it's so, like we're so, and similar, like we talked about the oil and gas industry sort of stopping the progress in electric cars. This is sort of like happening today in fashion world too, where just like this big brands by this like mega marketing or collaboration with celebrities or whatever, they're just trying to like change the conversation and be like, well, like it's not about that. It's about how cool you are or how hip you are or whatever. But I think Gen Z and onwards is so going to call out brands on, you actually do not walk the walk, you know, and I have faith. I have faith in the new generations to like question, which is why I feel like all the brands who seem to be niche today, like yours, is are going to be the one, they're one of the first ones who are doing right. And we're going to basically respect these brands. And I think there are a few, like I want to give a shout out to, and speaking of other like, I guess, progressive companies in the industry, like Patagonia was one of them. And maybe they also really started small. And now they actually are like becoming so much more of an authority in just like talking about sustainability. I have real respect, whereas like, it's not necessarily like fashion tech, but in terms of like a sustainable mission, Eileen Fisher has always been like, mindful that
totally
she's
agree.
Doing it. And I think
Stella McCartney,
exactly. I love this brand.
Yeah. She just goes for it. She goes, this is what I think I'm going
to
do.
Same like this brand that is from Spain, again, Eco Elf. They're also like trying to create garments that are from recycled plastic, but they're also trying, that's their only goal, but they want to do it right. I think I really also respect like whatever you define your problem is, which is another interesting brand. And I think you would enjoy this because she also has an architecture background, a Chromat, that is all about like, it's swimwear, but it's for all, it's their mission is all about inclusion and also tech, and her pieces are also like really like I can see she comes from an architecture background just because of the form and structure of the swimwear. So I think there are a few out there which are still like considered they're authorities in their own niche, but I think like that is definitely going to change. I 100% agree on that.
Yeah, I think you're going to have the people who pave the way into the future. And that's, you're always going to have that in any industry. And I'm happy to have the rough ride and do that.
Yeah.
Because my children could say, what have you done today? Oh, I made a t-shirt you can bury in the ground and it disappears in 12 weeks.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think like this is solely why we do What's Wrong With Too, is because like we always say there's really no solution to any problem without educating the end user. And we were seeing ourselves like as an architecture and design studio always doing this heavy research before we go into any project. And then we're like, well, first of all, we're keeping this information for ourselves. Second of all, if we had the conversation with other progress makers, this entire process would be so much more inclusive. And third of all, like, we have to raise awareness around the real underlying problems, not the surface look of things. So if we want to do that, this research should really be public. And our way of making it public was through panel discussions and podcasts. So which is very unconventional to see it for an architecture firm to do, but it really pushed us to have constant conversations with disciplines we're not familiar with, which I think architects should have to do more often. Any industry, like fashion, you're like talking about materials that the fashion industry, 90% of it probably, and this is totally my opinion, probably doesn't even have an idea of, like, oh, how would you even work with graphene, right? Like, it's so important, that exposure.
Yeah, well, that's what will help create the future, where I think learning from other disciplines. Yeah, certainly I don't look at the fashion industry to learn. I look at every other industry to learn. And that's and obviously with a training, you know, in architecture and in art direction, but you know, you can ideas of how to progress and make the future of stuff can come from anywhere, from an Oliver Eliasson exhibition to like flicking through a James Turrell book, anything. Yeah, I agree, the more you chat to other disciplines, you can only learn. It's impossible you can go backwards. You can't unlearn. Therefore, you're going to get something.
Selfishly for myself and just out of curiosity, when will you incorporate women's clothing?
The honest answer is as soon as we can.
Okay, great.
So when we set up, we had to choose men or women simply because you don't have enough money to do both well. And because we were both boys and we were born that way, we decided we'd start with boys. But we are fully aware that girls love adventure and girls love the future too. So the answer is we're working on it. It's just taking slightly longer than you wanted it to.
As long as you're working on it, it's totally fine.
Oh, 100%. Oh, gosh, yes. You just have to get the business into a state where it's an actual business. And then you can work on lots and lots of things, including that. Yes.
Perfect. And I guess to wrap up, and this was such a fascinating conversation, what would be your like one-liner advice to anyone who are going to push the boundaries in an industry?
Well, it's actually a piece of advice I got by a very famous advertising guy and creative guy who wrote some of the best films ever. And I hope I do it justice. And he said, if you can't do it, you can't do it. And if you can do it, you can do it. So it's all about mindset. I'm sure I've misquoted him slightly, but it's basically, if you have the belief you can't do it, of course you can't do it.
Right.
If you have the belief you can, you probably will. And I would say it took us into our mid-30s to work that out and work in that way, because you have nothing to fear, basically, because you just got to try and pull stuff off. And having that resolute belief that you will do it can get you a very, very long way. Obviously, I think your idea should be good if you're pushing that hard. I think it's honestly about mindset. And I think the one thing from the few autobiographies I've read, it's mindset. It's it's sheer drive. That's a creative thing.
Which is the only thing that will allow you to never give up. And I guess in Pixar's words, just keep swimming, right? So I think
that's right. Yeah, it is that. It really is. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
thank you so much, Nick. This was such a treat. Thanks for joining us.
It was great. Thank you very much.
So, Nick Tidball from Vollebak. Vollebak.
He said you said it right.
Yeah. I think I could trust him. So, what are some of the things we said that you think we had to like double check?
Well, the thing that stood out the most to me is the down feather, because I never knew that before a few years ago and before I bought my own Canada Goose, which makes me so sad. And now I don't want to use it, but I feel like that's making the problem worse. Like if I go out and buy a new one.
Yeah, you're feeding to the problem of overconsumption.
Just creating more waste.
So you can maybe do a public display of you regretting wearing that and like raise awareness and people will photograph you on Instagram and just share.
Go viral.
Yeah.
Anti.
Maybe that's the way to do it. Like I have so many clothing that I regret that I purchased at some point. All these like mega brands that use people as slaves and whatever, you know, like I think, which I don't want to like give any names now, but yeah, or I can like. I have so much stuff from Zara that I regret, but I still wear it. Yeah, but I still wear it because like if I don't wear it, then I'm adding to the waste problem. I'm adding to the...
I mean, you could also always donate and give to Goodwill.
That's true. I do that often. So you can just do that and then buy a sustainable brand. Or when the woman's version comes out, that indestructible...
I know. That's isn't that so amazing? Crazy. That's so great. Imagine a jacket that lasts 100 years.
And it, like I mean, if you can't cut through with a knife, why not?
Yeah. It's like $800.
Well, I guess it makes sense though, right? Like yeah. I feel like I have multiple coats around like the price point of 200 to 300.
Yeah, I think Canada Goose
probably the same.
Like expensive. Right. Yeah, I forget. Yeah.
And with lack of innovation and just cruelty. Yeah. Well, I mean, we're laughing, but we're nervously laughing funny. About it. Yeah. Yeah, that's like one problem, I guess, like the in fashion tech where the access and price point. But I think the perception, and it's this like is like we talked about with like Justin Lewis in the really beginning, right? The our perception around consumption has to change. Like we should, if we were buying like one item piece of garment yeah. per year, like and treat it more like an investment mm-hmm. rather than just like mood shopping every like 2 weeks. I think then it's like, oh, we pay like $3,000, $4,000 for a piece of sofa. So I think like $1,000 for a coat then like makes more sense when it's like, okay, this is going to last me a lifetime.
But instant gratification is such a devil. It's so hard to convince people to not buy something that will make them happy and invest in something that will last. True.
So I think like, I guess brands like Balabag who has like more functional features, leading the design, right? I think for them to really be a part of mass consumption is really requires for people to change their mindset.
Yeah.
And I think fashion industry just like did such incredible, like smart, like marketing throughout years. Well, first of all, by sort of dictating a certain size, they first like were lack of any technological advancement. Like the jackets I'm seeing, like they're like artwork because yeah. they're so like uncommon to see, right?
And they're really well thought out. They think about everything from the color to where you're going to use it, why you're going to, the hoodie, the relaxation hoodie, their first product. They on the website, they talk about how use it on a plane because you never know the fluctuations in temperature. You can zip it up over your face and no one will talk to you on the plane. You can sleep soundly. And the color, this drunk tank pink color.
Yeah, so, which is also researched. And that was fascinating.
So apparently it was used in an experiment in the 1980s in a prison. And just being surrounded by that color for 15 minutes was enough to stop all angry and antagonistic behavior from the guards and from the prisoners, which is so crazy. And it's
but I actually like that a men's clothing line also started off with like with a pink jacket hoodie, yeah. That's just like memorable. Okay, what else did we discuss?
He talks about like he talked about transparency, and he's like, in scaring people and doing new things, you know you're doing interesting things. Which I think is funny because he talks about like going to the factory and the factory is scared of him and
yeah.
his material. And he's yeah. like, this is what excites me.
Yeah.
That's cool. I think he's right. It's like how Corbusier felt or Gaudi felt. And it's, we need people like this who tell a different story.
That's so true. And it's the hard way. I mean, they're choosing the hard way and that's like not going to be common. I feel like, you know, we do tend to like always fall on the easier side of some things. And I think same for manufacturers. I think manufacturers, there are few manufacturers probably in any discipline that is like willing to take on a challenge. Mm-hmm. Or they would just like charge outrageous numbers and so that you can never take that challenge. So I think that mindset has to be in making since so much so many industries are just driven also by like vendors, and that entire supply chain has to be more bold and realize that, oh, if we want to be relevant for the future, we actually need to try out new things, right? I think like I love this product designer, Duffy, Christopher Duffy. He's a good friend of ours too. And he has these like artwork furniture where he cannot necessarily resolve like manufacturing process of it with a manufacturer at all, which is why he has his own workshop. Plus he works with multiple manufacturers to produce pieces. So he actually does the entire final assembly himself to ensure that he can produce it, right? And I think that shows dedication in realizing what you really vision, like how your vision for that piece. And I think that's probably what Balabek did too. Like if one manufacturer says no, you go to another one, you go to another one. But I think he was right on the mindset. In the end, you have to have that mindset and dedication and passion to really pursue something.
You know, I was watching this weekend, I watched Next in Fashion on Netflix. It's like the new
Yeah,
it's like Project Runway-esque, but it's supposed to be the future of fashion and who's next in fashion and who's groundbreaking. And
is it?
I mean, the designs, they might be like the designers. Once they talk about how denim is such a polluter and it uses so much water, and they talk about all these things, but I don't think that it's pushing the boundaries of fashion as much as they like to believe. I mean, it's a very cool show. The designers are really good. However, I think there's such a good platform to actually try something so different than what exists already in fashion and in these reality shows.
Yeah.
Because it's next in fashion.
Exactly. So the conversations have to be more advanced. Mm-hmm. I think like the problem is as we start to try to think in scale.
Yeah.
Because scaling sustainably is a problem, right? Like I don't even know if it's actually feasible.
Yeah.
At all. Like you may be sustainable in many things, but you won't be sustainable in some things.
Yeah. Like he was talking about, now they have to figure out how to transport these things across the world if they want to scale up and become a bigger brand.
You're like adding to carbon footprint, but then you use drones, but maybe the production of drones is not sustainable, you know, like this, like it's never ending.
Yeah.
Whereas like then I think the trend is going towards like you really have to be the authority in your own niche, and then the consumer's mindset is going to shift to, I don't want big brands anymore. I'd rather like all the boutique culture we had, like just a bunch of boutique stores, which like died because of all the chains. When the chain structure goes away, the boutique culture comes back, I think then we're just going to have like many micro brands that actually do it sustainably.
More creativity, more innovation. I think now because of mass production, there is no craft and people don't really take pride in the things that they're producing.
Yeah. Yeah. So true.
Yeah. He was such an interesting person to talk to.
I know. And they're like twin brothers too in it, so that's really cool.
Yeah. I don't know if I could work with my siblings.
That's something we didn't get into. That's true. Like we should have asked like, how is it working with your twin brother? I think it should be like, as a person who works with her spouse, as long as you're not doing the same thing, maybe it's easier because they have complementary skill sets.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Tune in next week when we sit down with Carolina and Claudio Recci from EdSites. EdSites is looking to help universities retain their students by addressing the dropout problem. EdSites is a chatbot that checks in with students on issues like engagement, homework, grades, and personal finance issues. For more information on our events and podcasts, visit us at whatswrongwith.xyz.